You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 81 is, what is the nature of the unconscious? And we read the first chapter of Carl Jung's Man and His Symbols, published in 1964. You can join the discussion, get the texts, and read numerous amounts of supplemental material at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Wes Allwyn, sensing and judging in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Mark Linsenmeyer, thinking, introverted, sensory, intuitive from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin blowing up the introverted-extroverted distinction in Austin, Texas.
Oh, man. Got to be outside the box.
I don't believe in that distinction, man.
I'm imprisoned in a conceptual scheme in a way that Jung would object to, and yet it's Jung's own conceptual scheme.
I am simply holding two opposing ideas in my mind simultaneously and continuing to function, which is a sign of my true intelligence.
Ground rules for our discussion include, number one, try not to assume our audience has read what we're talking about or has any other background in philosophy. Number two, don't make arguments that hinge on something other than what we've agreed to read. Don't say, you'd understand me if only you'd seen the new scare flick about carbon monoxide poisoning, collectively unconscious.
Nice.
That is terrible.
Number three, we will be rigorous and exact in all that we say, unless doing otherwise would be potentially more amusing. So we don't have to give a summary because Wes gave a nice over 10-minute summary posted separately as the precognition for episode 81. But we should say a little, Man and His Symbols was the last thing that he wrote in 1961 before he died. And he was approached after he'd done this interview that went well. The guy who interviewed him was approached by a book publisher to then approach Jung, asking him to write a book that would actually explain his system to the layman, because all of his work had been directed at other psychoanalysts and things like that. And initially he said no, but then he had a dream, and he listens to his dreams, that he should write this thing. So he did, but however, he had some stipulations that it would be a cooperative work. So there are like four other Jungian analysts that did sections of the book, and he just would write the intro and be the overall editor. So he picked these other people to write the meat of it, but he wrote this introductory essay, Approaching the Unconscious. And the guy, John Freeman, who wrote the introduction here, who was the journalist that initially was approached about this and kind of convinced him to do it, apart from the dream, convinced the dream to happen, convinced his subconscious to give him the dream. He was chosen by Jung that he had to be a consultant throughout the project for all the sections, pretty much to be an everyman, to read it over. And if he saw something that he didn't understand, he would have to make the author rewrite it. And it's not clear from the introduction whether that was applied to Jung himself or just to these other guys who helped. But it sure seems like this text goes out of its way to be clear. Don't you wish that, you know, Heidegger had done that, that Lacan had done that, that somebody, like, I will write one thing that you will actually understand, and I will have somebody tell me sentence by sentence whether it is understandable.
I don't get the sense, though, that this was heavily edited. It's kind of a rambling and repetitive piece of writing. And it's clearly it is for a public audience. I mean, clearly he's not getting into technicalities. And so, you know, that's why one of the things they did in the precog was to give an outline of Freud's theory of dreams and the unconscious, because even though he's responding to that, he really doesn't outline that in detail, which is unfortunate. So I think it's hard to understand his preoccupations with archetypes, and it's helpful to know Freud, but he doesn't help you get the gist of that.
What did you think, Seth? Was this a dumbed-down introduction and you wish we had read something real by him, or was this a wonderful introduction? This was actually recommended as the thing to start by. I threw it out on Facebook to our listeners, and this was
Think it was a good reading. If, like Wes said, you know, you put it on the stove and boil it down a little bit to get to some of the key points, it's not an argument. So what I came away with was him saying, here are a few key points. We have to take dreams as a fact and treat them like a phenomenon to be studied, et cetera, et cetera. But it falls back on him making his own claim to authority, which is to say his practice for the last 30 years or 40 years or whatever it was. So I wondered if there was another work somewhere that somebody actually did the empirical work to try to cash out by looking at hundreds and hundreds of dream analyses, what the archetypes are, what the recurring themes are, specific documented examples of where people who couldn't possibly have had knowledge of X, Y, and Z had dreams experiencing X, Y, and Z, that sort of thing. But it was provocative.
There's some reference in here to Jung having collected something like 80,000 dream reports.
Wow.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, the appeal to authority is just, this is what I found in my clinical practice. And I can give you some specific examples. So he does give the one that he goes into quite at length about a young girl. She's 10, 12 years old, and she had a series of dreams that she drew that had all these crazy-ass creation of the world revelations kind of stuff in it. That he says, there's no way that she would have been taught this stuff. She was not of the religion or religiously trained so as to get these things. But these are just natural things that people dream about, particularly when they're about to die, because within a year she was dead of an infection. And so somehow her body knew that she was going to get that infection. It was edging that way, and it was trying to let her know by giving her all this apocalyptic stuff. So that's the kind of thing that passes for an argument here, which is certainly interesting. And I think in the rest of this book, the other writers here give a lot of other examples there. And he's written many other books, just like Freud did, where he talks about his individual case studies. I don't know that I would find those personally as interesting as just this overview of the concepts involved, because what I liked about this was that it gives his version of a picture of the mind, and it contrasts in some important and practical ways with many of the philosophers we've read. It might be that the things that I really like about it, he has in common with Freud. The practical upshot, it almost sounds like Montaigne's skepticism that we read quite a while ago, where you might think that you've got everything figured out, that you can use your faculty of reason and be master of the universe, master of yourself. But come on, you're fooling yourself. The unconscious is still the vast majority of what is going on in your mind. Is stuff that you don't even know about. And if you look at your own behavior, aren't controlling. And if you actually step back and look at your behavior, you'll see that for every well thought out plan that you execute, there are also superstitions and quirks and other things that you can't explain where they came from and that would strike you as irrational. And that's just the human condition. So you have to do a study and engage in therapy or something to, I don't know, at times he talks about this goal of making more of the unconscious conscious, right? Actually gaining control of your emotions, gaining control of these things. But in other places, it sounds like he thinks that that is hopeless, that the best you can do is achieve some sort of balance between them. That if you are pulling too hard in one direction, then you are inevitably repressing other things that are really right there in your personality. So if you sort of define yourself, giving the example, you know, too rigidly as, I'm a person who's very reasonable and I have everything figured out, then the part of you that is, in fact, not like that will cause all sorts of psychological problems.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. It's only really teased in the essay.
Well, you started out, Wes, saying that the question here was about dreams.
Yeah.
Right? He thinks that the dreams are our unconscious talking to us, or is it always that?
What do you mean, is it always that?
Right, so he contrasts his view with Freud's, who thought, according to his characterization, that dreams are the things we've repressed. Sometimes, you know, so it can be our unconscious more or less talking to us, although that involves a notion of agency that we should try to flesh out a little bit. But then also it can be just the refuse of the day. It can be psychic trash, basically. And in fact, he credits Freud with discovering archetypes, with discovering that there are things that are in the unconscious that come out through dreams that are of things that you as an individual have not experienced, but that he thinks belong to something like species memory, which is what Jung is going to call the collected unconscious. But Freud just called those archaic remnants and thought that they were really not of any psychological interest, because the point of doing therapy and looking at your dreams would be to figure out what you personally are repressing, to figure you out, not to figure out something general about the species.
That's actually unclear to me how important Freud thought the archaic remnants were. But I mean, obviously Jung thought that Freud didn't think they were important. And yeah, so, you know, for Freud's, the first step is that dreams are symbolic. They're symbolic because the association, and I think this is an interesting connection, you know, because association is important to Hume and ultimately Kant becomes his sort of categories to the mind's structuring of the world. It's just that usually it's bounded in very tight ways, but it can free up. And it's obviously very free during dreams where one image sort of slides into the next and there's all sorts of contradictions and bizarre things happening that we would question in real life that we don't pay that much attention to while dreaming. So the symbolism comes in because our sort of emotional attachments to one image can easily get shifted onto another associated image. So one thing can come to stand in for another. Mm-hmm. And for people who are skeptical about this, even in literature, I mean, the way great literature is written, it's not like an artist consciously sets out to be symbolic. That usually makes it kind of ham-fisted and screws things up. rich symbolism comes when an artist lets go and just lets those connections happen more or less unconsciously.
So Orwell just wanted to write about animals, and it just happened that animals are.
A parable is a whole different can of worms. You can get away with that in a parable because you sort of frame it as a children's story, or you frame it as something quasi-mythological. And when you look at myths and fairy tales and parables, the characters are flatter. It's not about the depth of character. Normally, we criticize literature for the sorts of things that you do there, but actually, the depth is spread out among the characters in a fairy tale or a parable. Anyway, so I think that's a different case. But in most works of literature, we expect a more subtle kind of symbolism and that the author isn't forcing on to the story. So the thing that Freud and Jung agree on is that dreams are symbolic, but Freud really, he went farther than that. So for instance, I gave the example of my father being associated with a bear, or, you know, I could have any sorts of association like that. And so he might show up in the dream as a bear, and I might have a certain sort of similar emotional reaction to the bear in the dream. There may be sort of isomorphisms between my relationship to this animal in the dream and my relationship to my actual father. But for Freud, that sort of symbolism is really just scratching the surface. Freud thought dreams were really dominated by unconscious impulses that the dream is sort of giving partial expression to, but there's enough censorship to distort the dream and prevent us from becoming conscious of the impulses. So it's not enough to say, I have a conscious fear of my father, and that gets expressed in the conscious fear of the bear. For Freud, again, that's just the surface level, and we would have to go deeper and figure out what are the unconscious repressed impulses and how are those shaping the dream. And for Freud, this easier sort of symbolism, again, was not really the key to the dream. And I think Jung is trying to backtrack on that and say, actually, we ought to pay attention to the manifest, obvious symbolism of dreams, and it is important. And I think Jung has a very good point there. When I think about dreams, I think there's a lot of richness just to some of the overt symbolism in dreams before you try and use a Freudian method to see if there's something repressed driving the dream. I think Jung is right about that.
Hmm.
Was the bear Fozzie Bear in your case?
That's actually not a real association. I could give a longer example of a dream analysis.
Should we just talk about one of your dreams for the rest of the session?
No, not one of my dreams, but someone else came to me with a dream and challenged me. They'd actually listened to our Freud episode, and then I had lunch with them, and they were very skeptical about the idea that there's anything symbolic about dreams. But then they had come to me with a dream, and they like challenged me, interpret this. And actually, the interpretation was fairly obvious. And she had been basically talking about that dream through a whole previous conversation at lunch without knowing it. She had been talking about the same sort of preoccupation that showed up in the dream. And why wouldn't we expect those preoccupations to show up in the dream in some sort of jumbled up form?
Well, let's talk about what it is that is making the dream. That Jung wants to distinguish himself from Freud, that he says, for Freud, things are so jumbled in dreams because of the repression that's going on, because, you know, it's a forbidden desire. It's maybe an incestuous desire or something. The unconscious, even in your dream, it doesn't want to just say that, so it screws things up. Is that an accurate?
The dreams are jumbled up and distorted for two reasons, and Freud understands this, and so does Jung. One is just that we're not receiving external stimuli. Our ability to reason and reality test and to say, oh, King Kong's walking through my neighborhood, that doesn't make any sense. That kind of ability is dampened. So that's one level. The other part of the distortion is Freud's idea that dreams are trying to conceal our repressed impulses, conceal and express them at the same time. That's what makes it confusing. Give partial symbolic expression to them and yet distort them enough that we have to lay down on a couch and free associate and have a psychoanalyst help us figure out the actual meaning of the dream. So those are the two sources of distortion. And I think Jung wants to say, well, actually, just the mere fact that when we're asleep, that association is at work, that's actually enough. And there's something significant there. And that's so, he's lessening the importance of the part of repression in molding and shaping dreams.
I'd like to just dumb this down for just one second, because reading this, I didn't obviously have this context, Wes, that you're bringing to it. And I want to kind of go back to something I said earlier, which is, Jung's making a very strong and interesting point here to me, which is he's saying dreams are a phenomenon. They are a fact of our existence and they should be studied. And he said Freud recognized this, that it'd been neglected, that it's an essential part of human experience. And Freud's analysis of what the function of dreams was is to get at repressed memories or get at these repressed symptoms, neuroses, I'm not sure. And what Jung says is the fact that you can get at those same repressed things through free association while you're awake suggests that dreams do something more than just give access to those repressed memories or that repressed experience. And so he says, I want to know what other function dreams might have, what other work they might be doing as part of the human experience. And I think without passing judgment on or not knowing about how free association works in this context or whatever, I think both of those are very compelling points, even at face value, namely that dreams are something that need to be studied and are an important part of the human experience that's typically not addressed or wasn't until psychoanalysis developed into a field. And then the second, that the function that Freud uses for dreams or the role that he ascribes to them, if it's true that it can be achieved in other manners, doesn't necessarily imply that dreams have another function or a richer function, right? Just because you can do it multiple ways doesn't necessarily mean that there's more going on in dreams, but that it's a legitimate question to ask.
Freud thought the function of the dreams was actually to conceal our impulses from us. And even though it's a window into the unconscious and they give partial expression, the dreams come about because of that distorting aspect. They sort of push association into overdrive because association is how we distort and conceal. So if I had a forbidden impulse, say sleeping with my neighbors or my good friend's wife, I don't just dream about that. I dream about a distorted version of that, dreaming about some other woman who sort of stands in for my friend's wife. A patient can come in, you could go into an analytic session, and you don't just have them tell you dreams. They free associate about everything. They talk about the fantasies, they talk about their day. And often they're not going to talk about their dreams. And Freud spent a lot of time with people on the couch who weren't talking about their dreams. So the idea that you can free associate anything, I think you're right. Jung makes a big deal of that. That's not really an innovation on Freud.
I'm looking at 63 to 64. He asks, why, when asked, could not the dream be open and direct and say what it had to say without ambiguity? This is following up on him saying that the dreams are the unconscious trying to tell us something. And then he talks about Freud's view a little bit, that there's a sensor and the sensor protects your sleep against the shock of a disagreeable reminiscence. Mm-hmm. That these, if you really was disturbed, it revealed your repressed things, then you would wake up. Jung says, but I'm skeptical about the theory that the dream is a guardian of sleep. Dreams just as often disturb sleep. It rather looks as if the approach to consciousness has a blotting out effect upon the subliminal contents of the psyche. Earlier, he said one of the things he characterizes the unconscious is there are a lot of things that we notice that we don't know that we notice. I'm not sure how much this has just been debunked. I'm not sure how commonly accepted it was, but I thought for the most part, the idea that you could have like subliminal advertising, that has been shown just to be bullshit. That if you flash by Fritos in the middle of the movie for two frames, like the fact is that your sensory apparatus is not on any level going to get that. Is that correct as far as we know?
I think it doesn't work as an advertising technique, but I mean, cognitive scientists do lots of subliminal experiments these days and show that. But the other thing is, you don't need to buy into subliminal advertising, though, to get this point, because it's about the fact that our mind can only focus on one thing at a time. And
yes.
So I could focus my attention on the way the chair feels against my leg. And a moment ago, I wasn't conscious of that, but it wasn't exactly as if the experience wasn't there. So it was what Freud would call a preconscious, or what Jung would call a subliminal experience. And then I can become conscious of it, fully conscious of it, by giving my attention to it.
Right. I still think Jung overestimates how much of that is retained. That from what I remember from my psych classes in college, it was that unless you focus on it, you're certainly not going to remember it. It could be that you have a sense of what the chair feels like on your ass right now, but unless you're focusing on it, you know, you're not going to retain that unless somebody asks you. If somebody asks you after the fact, you probably won't, you know, you'll kind of figure out by looking what it feels like now, but you won't have actually retained that.
Ironically, yeah, I mean, that retention is actually related to dreaming. I mean, so there's something called memory consolidation.
Well, yeah, so Jung thought that you'd retain a lot of this stuff, but that it is retained in a way that is different than the conscious mind would organize things. And so the whole reason that dreams are so random seeming and filled with associations in the way that you were describing is just because that's how things are actually stored. And sort of if your mind is just going over contents, here it makes it sound like there's not an agent. Some places it sounds like he wants to say the subconscious is an agent, that the fact that we have a subconscious means that we are all divided selves. And then you could look at dissociative identity disorder as being an extreme version where you have many divided selves. But as far as dreams are concerned, if you say the dream is the unconscious is trying to tell you something, that sounds like there's another personality back there that is the whole. Sometimes he talks about the self as being the ego plus the unconscious, the whole you. And that's really what you're trying to work on, as opposed to what you consider yourself, which is just the ego, which is just has to do with the conscious mind, which is a socially constructed and very small piece of the whole self. But here it sounds more like Lacan's account of the unconscious, in which, remember, for Lacan, it was pretty much just strings of symbols. There's no agent there sort of doing anything. There's some motive force. There's still some life in the organism that is you.
Well, there's no agency for any of them. I don't
really,
think
you don't. Okay. This is the section that at least was clearest to me. Right. He says in 64, this is why dreams seem to skip the various points that are most important to the conscious mind, and seem rather to manifest the fringe of consciousness, like the faint gleam of stars during a total eclipse of the sun. A dream cannot produce a definite thought. If it begins to do so, it ceases to be a dream because it crosses the threshold of consciousness.
Right. So what he's getting at there is just the disordered, kind of distorted way that dreams present themselves is largely due to those first factors of, you know, again, the suspension of reality testing and external stimuli, and we're unable to focus when we're dreaming in the same way. And so that, of course, things are fuzzier. So he's trying to privilege those things again, as opposed to the Freudian idea that repressed impulse, the censorship, is the driving force, right? He wants to say, well, actually, you don't need censorship for dreams to be distorted. The distortion just comes in because the mind is in a nebulous state when we're dreaming.
I'm kind of getting a little lost already.
Well, we're focusing on the specific, what is going on, what makes dreams as fucked up as they are. And one of the things that came out of that for me is something that I feel like was a systematic, I don't know if it's an ambiguity, but it's something I had to figure out going through this, was, does Jung believe in agency at all, really? And I think that Jung is closer to, even though he talks about the self in a variety of ways, right, both as our conscious self and that we could have multiple selves if we have dissociated identity disorder, and also just, you know, he says you could just be caught by a bad mood. You could be suddenly very unreasonable. You could put on different personalities in different roles in your life, your work versus outside of work. And he sort of sloppily, I think, refers to all those different things as if those are different selves. Whereas I right. think it makes more sense to me to take the line of Sartre or Doug Hofstadter or many others who say all this points that the Cartesian notion of self, the cogito, is just kind of bullshit. It's a social construction. Jung does want to insist that there's teleology throughout. So you are alive. You are a collection of living systems. And some of these systems we'll call mental systems. You know, there's also, of course, the kidney functioning in such a way that you could talk about the mind of the kidney, the thing that moves the kidney. You could use that as metaphorical language. But I think that Jung is going to think it's not that much more metaphorical to talk about an agent behind even your conscious thoughts. You know, what pops into your conscious mind is not something that you cause to pop into your consciousness. It just, there's so much about our minds that we don't have control over it. We overestimate the amount of control.
Yes.
So there's this, the feeling of agency, sure, that's undeniable. Well, but whether there's actual agency, if you want to follow that route and say that there is actual agency in your conscious life, then you would then go ahead, like he does some places in here, and extend that and say, oh, well, I guess there are sort of multiple other agents within me that together make up my whole self.
I don't know that we're going to answer that question based on this text, but he takes a stab at giving an account of that when he talks about, in evolutionary terms, the kind of rational conscious part of the brain evolving more recently, and that these drives and the things that inform dreams come from kind of the older amygdala reptilian brain, which he suggests in quote-unquote primitive cultures and earlier civilizations we were more aware of and accepting of, that the rational brain hadn't quite crowded it out to the point where it had to express itself through the unconscious and dreaming. So he hints at a sort of quasi-biological account to answer your question, I think.
This question of multiple agents, he talks about on page 5 and 6. So he's citing a common criticism of the unconscious, of people who say, they argue naively that such an assumption implies the existence of two subjects, or to put it in a common phrase, two personalities within the same individual. But this is exactly what it does imply quite correctly. And then he goes on to say that many modern people suffer from a divided personality. But to say two personalities is not to say two agents. And I think the whole question of agency and free will is, you know, we don't need the unconscious to have a free will problem. We need merely to think about determinative factors on behavior, whether that's the unconscious or something else, it doesn't matter. So the free will problem is sort of more abstract.
You don't think it's made worse and more vivid, the fact that we, as a matter of fact, don't even feel like we have control? Or even if we sometimes feel like we have control, then if we sort of look more closely at our behavior and like, well, why did you do that? Then we figure, well, I can't actually explain why I did that on the basis of my rational choices.
The free will problem would frame it in terms of someone says, yes, I'm reasoning my way to a choice about what I'm going to do in the future. And someone says, no, you're just bound. You're like a billiard ball being bounced around the table, and you're bound by external factors, stimuli, your own impulses, all those causal factors come together and force you to make the kind of decision that you make. And then, of course, there are some people who think, well, actually, both those things can be true. We can save a conception of free will that allows for determinism, because scientifically, you know, it's really hard to break free of some sort of determinism for human beings. We're mechanisms. We're at some level machines and operating in the way that we're structured and determined to do. So you throw in the unconscious and you add a new wrinkle to the extent that you say the old debate might have been someone saying, well, you're just at the whim of your impulses, even if you think you're being reasonable. And the unconscious, the idea is that, well, even when you think you're following your own impulses, you may actually not be. You may be in a conflicted state. You may be following someone else's impulses, or you may be doing something that you may have an unconscious impulse that conflicts with your conscious impulse and so on. So what I'm trying to say there is that it adds an interesting layer to the many ways in which one can challenge free will. From a philosophical perspective, I don't think it brings on anything unique to that problem, which plays out at a more abstract level. Do you see what I'm saying?
I felt like I should stress that just because I think that's one of the things Jung stresses, that, again, like Montaigne, he wants to knock us down a peg from our embrace of reason.
Yeah, he's not knocked in any sort of corner on the philosophical problem of free will.
The reason you'd want to be a compatibilist is so you could acknowledge that, yes, we're determined overall, but there's still a difference in the way, say, we're going to apply the law or apply, you know, whether I'm going to feel guilty about something between if you did something and you were on drugs, or you did something and you felt that you were clear of mind. And so this adds another wrinkle to that sort of consideration. Within a completely compatibilist framework, fine. You could still say that part of the time you thought you felt free, when you looked at it more closely during therapy, you found that you were not. But I don't want to spend any more time on this because these things are not unique to Jung. This is Lacan. This is Freud. This is anybody who wants to talk about the unconscious. The reason I brought it up was just because I'm trying to figure out a way to talk about this sort of multiple selves. I mean, if it's not multiple agents, because that says something about free will and morality, you know, nobody thinks just because you get in a bad mood and you become sort of like a different person to somebody talking to you, that doesn't mean that you're not morally responsible. You know, it seems like at least if there's a chain of memory between the two selves and you're not an actual dissociated identity disorder person, then there's something metaphorical. He wants to claim that there are different, I would say, teleological systems. These different personalities, these different even roles that we put on really are in some sense different selves. If we want to say beyond that, that there are different agents, different cogitos or something, then we're exceeding the empirical data.
Well, all we have is this talk of two personalities and the idea of man being divided. And the point there is that he's getting at our lack of awareness of our emotions, or sort of the division from ourself, and our lack of ability to respond numinously to symbols. We're over rational, and we're, I don't want to use the word repress, because I think he uses this word discard and he's criticizing Freud on personal repression. But we've lost touch with our primitive selves, a more authentic and immediate relationship to nature and to each other and so on and so forth. So you could call this, as he does, you know, a divided personality, or two personalities existing within one person. One is sort of kept in a dungeon and not allowed to come out, but sort of pesters us. And that's where we get symptoms and neuroses and things like that.
Well, in the end, he actually makes the transition to talking about society in the same way, which stresses to me more that he actually thinks that these different personalities really, in some sense, could be called agents. If it's really such a close analogy to talk about the fact that the first world, the dominant, the West, is in a similar way to how man represses these ancient things, how we are denying really the agency, the values. We're not taking proper into account the rest of the world. And he refers to the Soviet Union at the time as sort of being our seedy underbelly that I'm not exactly, he doesn't go into depth of what his specific critique of the Soviet Union is, but I guess the idea is that there's a lot of corruption and things going on there and repression. And that in the same way that a all too moral person might sort of deny that he has evil impulses and say, oh, those criminals, in other words, like, I should have the right to have a gun or whatever because I'm trustworthy, but those criminals are a completely different species of person, pretty much. They have something wrong with their brains. Like, that would be the kind of thing that Jung would want you to wake up and see within yourself, that all the savagery that afflicts, you know, somebody that just killed his wife, that that's actually in there too, that just, it hasn't gained control yet. And similarly, you could talk about, he makes this analogy then to whole peoples and whether it's suppressing or ignoring other countries, or I think a more obvious analogy would be sort of the underclass of your own society, that if you have a society that's, we'll just focus on those bright individuals who have enough money and resources and the right background or whatever it is, basically an oligarchy of some sort, and everybody else, screw them, let them eat their breadcrumbs and make do as well as you can, that there's something screwed up in very much the same way that a person could be self-repressive. Which, of course, brings to mind Plato in the Republic, that he talks about the thing in the same way, that the soul, you know, this is when Jung was talking about, right, if you don't control your own emotions, then you're really not in control. That's one of the big things that would jump out, that you're not as rational and conscious as you think you are, is because you have these emotions. Well, that's, you know, he's got the people of spirit, the people of desire, Plato does. Were you guys not struck by that?
You covered a lot of ground there in one speech.
I just threw out the idea, since we were talking about agency, about what he does in talking about agency at the end of the essay, that he makes this into a social critique.
He's not talking about agency just because he's making moral pronouncements, right? You're implying that he must be attributing agency if he's making things that sound like moral condemnations.
He doesn't give moral condemnation. In fact, he refers to Nietzsche somewhere as being profound. He obviously, like Freud, read Nietzsche and thought that that was a good critique. You know, in fact, Nietzsche's criticism of rationality is very much the same thing that you see here, is that it's people fooling themselves if they think they're that rational.
But what he's interested in is, I mean, I still feel like this comes down to, he's observing a phenomenon and looking to explain it. And in a certain sense, Mark, I feel like you've kind of already up-leveled it to a philosophical conversation. But what he's saying, even when he's talking about Nietzsche, is he's talking about cases where people either use phrases, use archetypes, tropes, stories that they aren't consciously aware that they perhaps think that they're creating or that they think they've experienced, but in fact come from someplace else. Whether some place in the distant past in the user's experience, or mm-hmm. as he posits, some place they couldn't possibly have had access to. And it's that phenomena that he finds interesting. And I don't know that there's enough in the text to say that he comes down on one side or the other about the agency aspect of it. He's kind of leaving the door open in this particular work about the sort of mysteries of the way that the human brain works and that repression and this hyperactivity or hypergrowth of the unconscious as a response to the conscious mind and the rational mind, you know, is a symptom of the age. There's a lot of talk like that. I'm not saying what you're saying is wrong. It's not what came to me from the text when I was reading it. That was not a live problem that I felt like he was trying to solve.
Well, what did you make of the end of the essay where he was saying, from these things about the curing of the individual human soul, we can look at why social problems are the way they are? I figured that would be an area that would really grab you.
Well, I think I see that as an extension of what I was just talking about, which is he thinks that a lot of the social problems, particularly, I guess he was writing this during the Cold War.
Yes.
He's attributing a certain kind of malaise or sickness to the way that human beings relate to each other by virtue of the fact that they're not in touch with and not honoring these. Actually, this goes hand in hand with what I guess we either have or will be talking about in the Heidegger technology discussion, that as we've privileged this rational part of the brain and we've fooled ourselves into thinking that we can encompass and grasp all of our experience through reason, then the aspects of our experience that don't fit that we're denying come up more and more through these manifested in dreams, through these unconscious expressions to try to balance out. But that attempt to compensate itself is indicative of an imbalance that's kind of like a neurosis of the age. And that's what's causing people to deal with each other fundamentally in a terrible way or a poor way.
Right. So he refers to World War II, to the Nazi, is like an outbreak of this repressed awfulness.
Yeah, that's not a particularly compelling or sophisticated analysis to me. But as you mentioned earlier, he's right in line with many of the other critics who put the blame for all the shit that went down in the 20th century at the hands of the Enlightenment. To me, his criticism of the prioritization of consciousness, really more so than reason, he doesn't use the word reason so much as he talks about the conscious mind, and is really a criticism of the Enlightenment, which, by the way, I'm sympathetic to.
You know, this brings out another important distinction from Freud, you know, who talked about religion as an illusion. And Jung here, of course, and this is one of the things that led to a falling out between Jung and Freud, where Jung ended up sending some very bitter and actually really kind of unhinged letters to Freud. Seriously. For Freud, you know, religion was an illusion, and Freud is focused on using dreams to unearth unconscious impulses. And Jung, he's interested in a different part of the unconscious, what he calls the collective unconscious and the archetype. He wants to get us back to this sort of primitive mind and to a relationship to the world, again, in which our symbols, instead of simply showing up at night in dreams, are an actual part of our life, which is something we've post-Enlightenment lost. So Jung is bemoaning the loss of religion and religious ritual and the kinds of customs which put us in a kind of, in a sort of, again, primitive relationship to nature. So for instance, the getting up at dawn and worshiping the sunrise, something like that. So it's an interesting position because it's not clear what we can do about that, right? And so there's some ways in which this essay is a lot like Jung's version of civilization and its discontents. He goes on at length about the civilizational causes of human misery. But his solution seems to be a call to go back to, or at least to try and reintroduce some sort of religious way of living into life. And it's unclear to me how you would accomplish that.
Yeah, it seems the primary psychological thing here is an observation of the current state of society. And, you know, so he says in 94, anthropologists have often described what happens to a primitive society when its spiritual values are exposed to the impact of modern civilization. Its people lose the meaning of their lives, their social organization disintegrates, they themselves morally decay. We are now in the same condition.
Mm-hmm.
But then he says some things about modern religions that, you know, like modern Christianity, by putting the Bible between us and sort of the matter of religion, there's a problem there too. I mean, what he really wants is this, he wants symbols to be numinous to us, which is that they have a connection, a personal connection, that they inspire something emotional. And that's really what the archetypes are all about. It's a symbol that has an emotional connection. He said that's how he defines it. But then he says, but really, we're talking about something that can't be put into words. And for instance, when you're talking about a particular symbol, if you've never experienced its numinosity, if you've never experienced it as meaningful, as powerful, you don't really know what you're talking about. It's like you're in a dream, he says. So you could become a scholar. He thinks that we should learn about myths, become scholars of the world's mythologies so that we can recognize these images. And he is very careful to distinguish between the archetypal images, which are like the cross or the phallus or many other things, and archetypes themselves, which he says are not specific images. They are instinctual impulses to create spontaneously these images.
Yeah. Images of a certain type. So
yes.
Yeah.
Or practices.
Yeah.
I was looking at the Wikipedia thing on him about his biography and how as a kid, he made a little sort of a voodoo doll kind of thing and put it in his bed and like went and sent it little notes and stuff. This is like when he's a little kid. And then later he realized, oh, this is totemism. Primitive people were doing that for a long time. And there, that was just a natural thing for me to do. All this stuff that he's talking about very much relates to his personal experience. Like he had these dreams that had that predicted World War I and presaged all this stuff. So this is for him, not only is a matter of reporting on his clinical practice, but it's phenomenological. He's reporting on his personal practice. And he was his own first subject. He thought he was going insane and he kind of talked himself out of it. when I was reflecting on this, I was like, I don't feel like I have any dreams that I can remember with these weird images in them. They're all just me figuring out at the end of the semester that I haven't been going to a class that I was signed up for the whole time. I'm going to get, you know, it's these very boring, being naked in a public place, losing my stuff. If these things that do not require any Jungian mechanisms to explain. I don't know, did this text personally resonate with you as far as the archetypes were concerned?
With me, no, because I'm actually one of those people that doesn't remember their dreams. So this is actually all a very theoretical exercise, and I only can operate on hearsay and what other people have told me about their experience in dreams, which seems to be more along the lines of what you're talking about, Mark. You know, like 90% of dreams that people tell me about are anxiety dreams and things like that. Certainly, I don't recall anybody ever telling me that they had a dream that I could somehow relate to Revelations or some world myth, you know, about a giant whale swallowing somebody or something like that.
If you started writing down your dreams, you'd start remembering more of them, and then you'd see a greater variety.
Well, you've done more of this self-investigation.
Yeah.
Does this Jungian stuff resonate with you, Wes?
Well, the archetypal stuff doesn't exactly. I do have recurring dreams of astronomical images, and from a child I had these. So there'd be like another planet circling the Earth, and I could look and see in detail what was going on that planet, and just kind of fantastic scenes of the sky, which felt very primal in a way. But other than that, no. That sort of more archetypal imagery, I haven't experienced that. But it's not like I've gone through periods of remembering my dreams, but, you know, I haven't done a lot of it. Certainly not as much as Jung did, or any psychoanalyst who gets a lot of dream material from people.
But this all seems very incompatible with the idea of lucid dreaming that I've done on and off and tried to pursue as a conscious thing. I read some book about it. Just realizing you're in a dream and like, I'm going to fly now because I can, because I learned you know, the technique of doing that in a dream. And I want to keep from turning awake, so I'll spin around in the dream. That's one of the ways to sort of keep from waking up.
Yeah, it never works for me. Yeah, I've done a fair bit of lucid dreaming as well, where you wake up, although the question of, you wake up within the dream, but you're also perilously close to being awake. Mm-hmm. And that's why you have all these tricks to try and keep yourself from, you're using these faculties, which are normally, like I said, I think are dampened while you're dreaming. So you're able to pay attention in a lucid dream and reality test and do lots of things that you're normally not able to do. But anyway, the thing that I think that Jung is right about is that dreams are symbolic and dreams are reparative. And I think, you know, modern science is sort of on this path that people don't agree. There's lots of research, of course, into the functions of dreams, and it's kind of a mystery. Some of it has to do with memory consolidation, which also has a lot to do with primitive emotional systems in the brain. And, you know, Mark, you were talking about what we retain. Well, in the short term, we do retain quite a bit, and then it gets winnowed out at night through the process of dreaming, and the mind sort of decides what to keep.
Well, I think this is a good transition to talk about, in general, his distinction between signs and symbols, that this is not even just specific to dreams. He thinks, for instance, every word, even if it has a specific, its function as a sign would be its, what we ordinarily think of as its meaning, that it has a specific, maybe it has an actual definition, necessary insufficient conditions, maybe not. But in any case, the sign for sheep, the word sheep points to that particular kind of animal and other animals like it. Mm-hmm. Whereas he thinks that every word also has a bunch of associations surrounding it.
Yeah, so connotation, basically.
Yes, connotation versus denotation. So I just never heard that referred to that before, as its symbolic value has to do with the connotations and not just the denotation.
Well, not just connotation, but unconscious. So, you know, this is the page 4 we're talking about here, where he gives this distinction. So symbols have unconscious meanings associated with them. That's the important part there. So any word can have different connotations for different people and that they're conscious of. A symbol is representative of something that we can't really get at with words.
Sure. So the things that could be in the unconscious, there are lots of ways they could have gotten there. And it's sort of by necessity, we don't actually know what the bottom of the unconscious is. Maybe, in fact, we are at bottom all the same person, this monopsychism. There's a unified social self that the entire human race actually shares at the bottom of this. That's one of the interpretations, a strong interpretation, much stronger than we see in this text, of his idea of archetypes. Everything he says in here makes it sound like archetypes are just instincts. You can explain them just using nice Darwinist evolutionary biology. It doesn't mean that we are psychically connected to every other individual right now or anything like that.
Right.
But he's open to that kind of thing. In other works, he worked during an era when parapsychology was taken more seriously. There was more research done into it. It had not been so thoroughly debunked. So there's a question when you say something's unconscious of what does that mean? Certainly any word, even if the connotations could be things that were conscious. In fact, even anything that you're not actively thinking of right now, he considers unconscious. But there's a lot of that stuff, you know, if then I remind you of it and you say, oh, yes, and you can say what the word means or whatever, then that's not unconscious in the interesting sense.
There's unconscious, yeah, right, in the sense of preconscious, which you were just describing. Then there's unconscious in the sense of stuff that we can't make conscious just by turning our attention to it because it's been repressed. But it's unclear exactly what he means here, because he says, so this is page 4, that's a word or an image is symbolic when it implies something more than its obvious and immediate meaning. It has a wider unconscious aspect that is never precisely defined or fully explained. No one can hope to define or explain it. As the mind explores a symbol, it is led to ideas that lie beyond the grasp of reason. So I think he thinks this is unconscious in the sense that it's beyond the grasp of reason. But again, this isn't the same thing as the Freudian repressed unconscious. We have a new category of unconscious here, and I think that's what the archetype and collective unconscious get at. It's not personally repressed in the sense of being a forbidden impulse, but it's not simply preconscious in the sense that it can easily be put into the light of day, but he still wants to call it unconscious and inaccessible in some sense.
Well, it could be something can't be easily brought in the light of day because it's just so diffuse that you have so many experiences with even a word or an image that Jung thinks these all get stored in some way in you, and that it's the function of intuition, that this whole distinction between sensation and intuition, that somebody whose their personality type is strongly sensory will focus on the one thing right in front of them that they can grasp and say something definite about, whereas an intuitive type will sort of, you know, make a call, will have a hunch based on a lot of stuff that could have been, in a very ordinary sense, perceived in the past. So any expertise in judging something comes from this intuition that we have years of experience or whatever and all these different, and there's no way to bring your exact reasoning for coming up with this intuitive judgment to light just because it's coming from such a diffuse place, so many places. That's a very harmless way of taking intuition, that it's just a way of synthesizing past experiences. But if intuition is really the unconscious speaking, or you drawing on the unconscious, again, if we don't know where all the stuff in the unconscious came from, then the intuition also could be a more or less magical faculty that is getting at whether it's the monopsyche, the world soul, or something else, something from the species past.
Right. He's not talking about anything magical in this reading, right?
Right. I think this is purposefully phrased to be like, this will be as reasonable. I'm not going to say anything weird that's going to freak you out. But a lot of his appeal over time, I mean, I listened to a podcast on Jung that was on an astrology podcast, and it's not an accident. I was looking through the Portable Jung, and he has a essay in there on synchronicity, which is basically advocating, saying, look, there's just a matter of fact that there are lots of implausible coincidences out there. And he's not making any grand theory and saying it's the world soul talking or any of that. But he says this is data, you know, just like people, like I was saying, took ESP seriously. He's at a point in history, or you could say he was open-minded enough or whatever, that he doesn't want to just take a materialist view of nature, a strictly causal view of nature, and rule out anything that runs counter to that as miraculous, as improbable on Humean grounds. You can rule it out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he doesn't speak to any of that in this reading. I can't.
I broke the law, but we had to acknowledge it, though.
2 feet good, 4 feet bad. So I don't know if I've actually read any Jung before this or not. If I have, it's a very long time ago. But I do remember that there was a period of time when Joseph Campbell was really hot. Bill Moyers had him on all the time, and everybody was reading The Hero with a Thousand Faces. I don't know if you guys remember, there was a guy named Houston Smith.
The name is familiar.
Who was a student of Campbell's, who, I think he was a student or a peer. He came to UT while we were there and spoke. So, you know, Houston Smith was like a yoga guru and the sweetest guy who ever lived. And, you know, he came and was in the tail end of his career, right? So he's just kind of making the rounds and whatever. And Hochberg.
I'm looking on his Wikipedia.
Jesus, is he? Wow. That's impressive. I mean, he was, and he wrote this book called The Religions of Man, where he basically tried to do the Campbell Jungian thing and find the same thread in every single major religion, you know, that they were all just playing off the same archetypes. And I remember that Hochberg and Allaire sat up in the front row and basically like heckled him during the Q&A. They were just like with their arms crossed, you know, being complete douchebags that they were. The point being that Jung was popularized through Campbell, and my association with his ideas was derivatively through Houston Smith and Joseph Campbell. And I'm curious as to how much of that is actually really Jungian and how much of it is he kind of makes statements like he does here, which suggested things, and then people took them and made a lot more out of it than there actually was.
Jung at least is he's a psychologist, and he's one of the things he criticizes is people that rely too much on fantasy, on wishful thinking, etc. And I think he might have had a little bit of impatience with a lot of the New Agey kind of views from that perspective. But he also was not going to rule out data that was well supported, even if it, you know, he didn't have a paradigm to explain it. So we should use this as a transition to get back to talking about religion, that some of the things he says in here sound very much like Kant, that you say there's no proof for the existence of God. Well, there's no disproof either. It's just, it's the kind of thing that can't be proven or not. In fact, you know, so he has an apophatic view of God, that God is not even something that can be understood or put in a word, such that, you know, if you're going to have any evaluation of whether you should be religious or not, it should not be on scientific rational grounds, because those don't apply to it at all. It's just a completely different sphere. And so what you would want to look at from his perspective is psychological health. I know in a different, somewhere else in the Portable Jung, I remember reading this as a post-undergrad. I sort of read through the whole Portable Jung, and he said something to the effect of, who's going to be more psychologically healthy? Somebody that believes he's in a house that's about to collapse on him, or somebody that is completely oblivious of that fact, even though the house still is going to collapse on him. By comparison, do you want to believe in an afterlife? Well, he thinks it's actually healthy to believe in an afterlife, to believe that there's meaning. This is in this text. He says, we cannot psychologically bite the bullet like somebody like Camus would recommend and embrace that we are, I'm trying to remember what the phrase he used in here, but that we are puppets, you know, acting out a meaningless little game, something to that effect. We are not in a shape that we can accept meaninglessness. Meaning is something valuable to our lives, and having numinous images is one of the ways that we get it meaning, you know, maybe the only way. It also reminded me of McIntyre's, you know, another critic of the Enlightenment that we read, of his criticism of the existentialists, who seem to think that you could say McIntyre was concerned with ethics, that you could get ethics just by choosing them. I just choose to adopt this. And I don't need an objective ethical thing, a standard, an external standard out there to adhere to. I will just choose to embrace it, because McIntyre said, well, then you could just as easily discard it the next day. There's nothing that would make you actually stick with it. There's no sense of an actual commitment unless there is an objective thing that you are sort of joining your will to. And so Jung uses something very similar when talking about meaning, that you can't just, as an existentialist would recommend, just say, well, fine, I'm going to take meaning in this and just do it. No, you have to kind of be called to it in some way. It has to, it does seem like the only objectivity required is that your unconscious wants to do it. That itself could give you meaning. It doesn't have to be some external religious creed that you've inherited from something. It doesn't have to be something like that, but at least has to be something that you feel a calling toward. And these numinous images, which are the things of religion, are the most common way that that's done.
Mm.
I don't know. What'd you think about this numinosity stuff? We need numinosity. We need symbols that are meaningful to us, that sink deep into us, that have spiritual energy to them, which just means an actual connection to us personally in ways that we don't understand. Are we all just two jaded Westerners that he's complaining about? We can't get this.
You know, there are still people who are genuinely religious, right? If one doesn't have that, it's not something you can simply manufacture in yourself. Or, well, St. Augustine thought you could participate in rituals long enough where you could habituate yourself into faith, into receiving grace, let's say.
Jung thinks we're acting out these rituals already, that modern people act out in a ritualistic way, in a way that's not that different than, you know, the people going to worship the sun in the morning. It's just that we don't realize we're doing that. We don't take responsibility for it, but we don't acknowledge and explore the connection to that.
We have neuroses and obsessions and things like yes. that instead of actual rituals. A ritual is a collective thing. It's something, you know, you're not crazy for engaging in it, and it doesn't cause the same sort of distress, you know, quite the opposite. Neuroses and rituals have lots of similarities, you know, especially in someone with OCD. So for instance, someone who has to superstitiously turn on and off the light 12 times when they enter a room, because if they don't, their mom is going to die or something like that.
We agreed that we weren't going to get personal on this one, Wes.
Exactly. Well, that's the tip of the iceberg. Yeah, so that's ritual gone wrong. I don't know what you can do. You know, so for when Nietzsche diagnosed this condition and says God is dead, he didn't think that the solution was give CPR to God. Another resurrection of a sort. Nietzsche was also looking for meaning, right? He was anti-nihilist. He thought nihilism mm-hmm. was bad for society and ought to be overcome in some way. But it's not through a return to religion. I think Nietzsche didn't think we had that choice.
Not religion, but spirituality.
Right. I mean, and that's actually a good point. I mean, I may be mischaracterizing Jung in the sense of I'm suggesting that he thinks we can return to primitive rites or become a Christian, even if we don't have that background and tendency to be born again or whatever. But I think you're right, Mark. We don't see much of that positive account here. Maybe he's calling for...
He's calling, authentic religion.
Yeah, I don't know how you would define it.
But. I'm kind of getting taken away from what I read by the way we're talking about it. If we honor Jung's view that he sees himself as a doctor, as a psychologist, right? What he's doing is diagnosing a condition. He's seen it in individuals, like he said, for 50 years or however long he practiced psychiatry. And then he's making a diagnosis of the malaise of the age. I'm just not sure that we have to go to where you guys are going with it. The type of language that he uses in this particular essay, he says things like, instinct and uses terms like meaning, and he's describing some kind of biological evolutionary response to phenomena in the world that as we have evolved our rational brain and as we've become more dependent on our conscious mind and done away with rituals, symbols, activities that made sense of what our body and our instincts and the world were telling us, that's where we're starting to go astray. And religion simply functions to do something that he sees done in lots of different ways in lots of different cultures. I don't see him saying anything about the response to the death of God or what have you, so much as he's saying there are key parts of what it is to be a human being that are instinctual, non-rational, and all of these rituals and things that we've developed over thousands or tens of thousands of years are designed to cultivate that, and for our mental health, they need to be there. But in the last 100 years or so, we have turned those things away and forgotten them and given them up, thinking that we can replace them 100% by logic and reason and conscious activity. And what's happened is they're not going away. They're just creeping up through the unconscious and the stream activity. And that is causing these neuroses or psychological disorders, which in turn manifest themselves in the ways that they do in the greater society that we've seen through World War II and the Cold War and all that.
So if you want to put that in terms of meaning, you might say, I'm an existentialist badass and I don't need a god to come and tell me what my meaning is. I can figure that out for myself.
To put it in terms of meaning, we think we can manufacture meaning through some kind of conscious, rational analysis of the world. And what he's saying is, no, there's a big part of meaning that comes through something other than that.
Yep.
But we pretend like it's not.
Right. That even if you're not a philosopher, you know, an existentialist, you know, the way an ordinary person would do that is by, he thinks, consumerism, by I will make money through my job. I will spend money to buy cool stuff. And he thinks that is not a good recipe for spiritual fulfillment.
And he's right.
Let's see. So did we talk about enough about signs versus symbols? You know, the thing that was unclear to me about the symbol aspect of something, sometimes you talk about the symbolic, the associations on a personal level. Of course, you know, we've all had different experiences with signs. And so each of us has a personal meaning to every word we say. And so if we misunderstand each other, it's because we have a different cluster of associations with that word, apart from its explicit definition, or, you know, probably doesn't actually have an explicit definition. It's just a prototype and borderline cases and all that kind of stuff we talked about in the Wittgenstein episode. So you could see where that stuff could get vague. But then sometimes he also talks about symbols as extra personal. It's not just what you have in your head when you mean a word. It's the symbolic connotations of the word or of the picture itself. The picture of a cross or something, and that these are have, of course, social aspects. And so you could very much, like Heidegger did, delve into the etymology of a word. And that would be a legitimate, I think, way for Jung of exploring its symbolic components. You know, you might not have known the etymology, but that's part of the symbolic component of the word. And then presumably there would be also the things he's most interested in are those words or images where you delve far enough into it and you can't come up with something that is not even obviously transmitted by culture or from your personal experience, that it is instinctual somehow. Is that a satisfactory account of symbols? Or I can just see Frege or one of these guys trying to respond to it like, well, who cares what's in your head personally when you say a word? The word's got a meaning. You don't get to decide what it is. I don't know. Maybe they're just using this for such different purposes. There's nothing really, no useful back and forth we can have between the figures here. Did reading about symbols and signs bring to mind the semiotics guys or Frege or any of that?
There was someone we read who went into connotation. I forget who that was. So it's not like it's, you know, he's getting at sense as opposed to reference or something like that. And I don't think there's much meaningful interaction there, because what we're talking about are associations. We're not talking about semantics in the strict sense.
Mark, when you mentioned symbols, are you talking about the archetypes?
Well, it's funny that he starts out the essay talking about it in terms of words, but then he makes this movement, which is unique to him in the stuff that we've read, I think. I'm thinking back on our first semiotics episode, from words to images. That could just be the symbol of a cross has associations in the same way that the word dog does, the word sheep.
Take my bear example. It can be personal or it can be archetypal and available to us collectively. My example of associating my father with a bear, the bear is symbolic of my father. That's a personal association, which I don't expect to be archetypal. I don't expect most people to have that association, right? So the archetype is just symbolism, except it's so fundamental, or at least it's some image that's expression of a fundamental instinctive tendency to represent things that way. So we would call that archetypal. But in both cases, symbolism isn't meaning in the sense of, you know, I use bear to refer to this set of objects that have these properties. It's simply about association. It's simply about the way in which one idea can lead us to another idea. The archetype just gets at the sense in which there are fundamental patterns to association that stem from our basic shared psychical structure as human beings.
Well, I think we're on the edge of talking about a linguistic theory that actually would apply Jung's insight and say that all reference is metaphorical in a way. You know, this is just reflecting what we were just talking about in the Heidegger and in
right.
the...
This is metaphor.
Yes, yeah. You're right. You can run with that, but Jung doesn't. So I guess that we can leave it at that for the moment.
It becomes a very thorny problem trying to distinguish metaphor from...
Yeah. I mean, even what makes a metaphor a symbol work, you know, that when you gave the example of the bear for your father, that didn't seem like an arbitrary personal thing, but I could very just easily slip into, not that every father would be accurately represented as a bear, but you know what that means, that it's some sort of fierce animal that
right,
is threatening
right.
you. And isn't that the universal take on fathers, according to Freud?
Right. You could easily argue that that's archetypal. But in the example I gave, I was saying, well, my father's name is Barry. So there, it's a personal association. But you could say, yes, there's an archetypal layer because of what bears are and what fathers are.
All right. What about past and future in the unconscious? We didn't talk about that so much, that section. You know, he makes the point that we've already made that neurotic phenomena are no more than pathological exaggerations of normal occurrences, so that we can look at the people with psychological problems to tell us something about how the mind works. And everybody knows that, you know, so we look at split brain patients, that tells us something. For instance, this is not his example, but it's an often used one in psych classes. The right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing, that you can, you know, have somebody put something, if they have a split brain, then you put something in their right hand visual field.
Wait, does he talk about this?
No, he doesn't talk about this at all, but that this is exactly the kind of stuff that is often brought up to collaborate. Some of his talk of multiple, not multiple agents, but multiple minds within the self, multiple centers of teleology, something like that, that you could have something that's in part of your visual field, that if you have a certain brain injury, then if I ask you, is there something there, you won't see it. But yet, if I then have you write it down or have you just guess, you'll know better than average. You know, so it shows that there are these separations within us.
Wow, you're like a pit bull, man. Once you latch on, you do not let go.
I'm just using that as yet another example of this thing in this past and future in the unconscious.
I took the role of this section, right? He's trying to say that unconscious contents of our minds have a profound influence on our daily life. And that influence is not simply psychopathological.
What does that mean?
Meaning, I might discover the structure of benzene because of a dream, for instance. So the unconscious is the font of creativity. That's one of the examples. And then he talks also about premonition in this section. It's not that simply that the repressed unconscious contents of my mind lead me to be neurotic, but they have other positive effects as well. He gives an example of these subliminal effects, these triggering effects of forgotten memories. This section gives you a sense in which symbolism is an important part of our daily life in the sense, again, of through association. A girl, for instance, may be busy in her office, apparently in good health and spirits. A moment later, she develops a blinding headache. Okay, so this isn't a positive example, but and shows other signs of distress. Without consciously noticing it, she has heard the foghorn of a distant ship, and this has unconsciously reminded her of an unhappy parting with a lover whom she has been doing her best to forget. Sometimes people will get into these moods without knowing the association. They won't know that, oh yeah, I associated this foghorn with my lover, unless they talk to a friend about it or unless they go talk to an analyst about it and you say, oh, okay, I see what triggered my mood. These two things are associated in my mind.
He makes another point in here about cryptomnesia, concealed recollection. So unintentional plagiarism that he wrote a whole thing. And it turned out to be a plagiarism of a story that he read as a kid. And his sister had to tell him that. At some point in here, he says, what is our relationship to our wider self, to our own unconscious? How the Greeks referred to this as their demon, their daimon, like we see in Socrates, and how the Romans referred to it as genius. There are other societies that really acknowledge that you have this inner voice, this part of you that you kind of have to deal with, that it's, you can't just order around. That's part and parcel with him saying you should listen to your dreams. And so talking about that in terms of creativity, I think is great. And relating that back to the cryptomnesia thing, that so much of what we think is creative genius is intuition in the sense of regurgitating a synthesis of things that we've taken in before. If it's put together in a unique way, then what makes it seem so genius is that it probably wasn't consciously put together that way. Like you were saying at the beginning, Wes, about how good writers don't intentionally put symbolism in there. It's just that the way when we're being creative that we
right.
erupt this stuff, yes, involves a lot of synthesis and complexity. And there's cool stuff going on in the unconscious. I remember reading Stephen King talking about the work crew in his basement that figures out the plots of his stories, that he'll like get an initial idea and then just sort of set the work crew going. And they'll figure out the story and then he'll just sit down and write the thing.
Yeah.
That was a funny image. So that would be an example of, you know, what's wrong with modern society. And I see this as a continuation in some way, a slightly different perspective of the Heidegger that we talked about last time, that if you are not in touch with being, if you're not in touch with yourself, you're missing out on a lot. You're not being creative. You're alienated in some significant way. Did this not yell Heidegger at you, Seth?
Not as loudly as some other stuff that we've read. Let's see. There's a section, and I apologize. I have the location as far as Kindle's concerned, but I don't know what page it is.
That's funny, because Wes's and my pages numbers are not the same either. So none of our references.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we seem to be off by 20 pages or so. Mine has an introduction, I guess.
There's a part towards the end of that chapter where he says, emotional manifestations to which such thought patterns belong are recognizably the same all over the earth. This is that section where he talks about the Roman attitude, life is a short dream. And I made a note that this reminded me of the thing that Flanagan said when we quote unquote interviewed him about Buddhist psychology. You know, that the Buddhists had done this extensive psychology and come up with the 21 or 22 different moods or attitudes that people have. And it's much less psychology in the sense we think of it now, but much more like an anthropological kind of psychology, if you will. And that seemed to be more in line with what he was talking about here. You know, Jung is saying that these instincts that manifest themselves in symbols through these archetypal drives are the same all over the world.
Yep.
That, you know, in one place it's a tomb, in another place it's a cross. You know, here it's something consuming something else. Here it's rain, whatever. And that to me was much more in line with what we talked about when we talked about Buddhist doctrines, specifically around the psychology. We didn't read the book about, but Flanagan mentioned it when we had the conversation, and that approach is much more like, when we say psychology, it's not really psychology in the sense that we mean it now in the 20th century, which is a diagnosing mental disorders and that sort of thing. It's more about an empirical approach to studying what types of dispositions and moods people can have.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's a much more pan-cultural or pan-societal kind of view. Now, there's no argument made for it here. It's just sort of stated, but it's clear that that's Jung's position, right?
Yep.
And I found that interesting because, you know, he talks about how we're animals. There's an evolutionary aspect to this. I keep coming back to this evolutionary biological aspect, but I think it's important. And yet, he also talks about that in practice, everything comes down to the particular. So he's got sort of two threads working here. One where his framework is general and he believes there's a framework in which we can apply to all people with respect to the manifestation of the symbols and the drives. And he needs that because he needs the empirical data of these dreams mm-hmm. to not be culturally bound. But at the same time, any particular analysis or therapeutically approaching an individual is always a one-off case.
Yeah, in fact, I really wanted to talk about that, his whole tack in here about the practical problems of being an analyst of dreams, of what that involves. One of his things about symbols and this distinguishing between, you know, that there are different kinds of symbols and some of them have personal and some of them have cultural and some of them have instinctual archetypal significance, is that you can't just get your symbol, your dream interpretation book out and read an example in a textbook and like, now we're all going to examine this dream. Like, no, you have to actually be confronting the person. And then because it's you confronting the person, you really have to understand yourself. Thing that
you could project.
Right. The analyst's whole personality is the only adequate equivalent of his patient's personality. And mm-hmm. I remember you saying a long time ago, Wes, maybe it was in the Freud episode, that there's all these different theories and mechanisms about what kind of therapy works, but it really just comes down to whether your therapist is an asshole or not, like about their personal judgment. And Jung pretty much says that here, that it much more matters that the quality of the practical wisdom of the analyst.
Yeah. Well, I was citing studies that, you know, and again, those are limited studies about whether or not you see these sorts of improvements when people fill out these forms to say how depressed they are or something, and you get pretty uniform results between different types of therapy, and then one could discuss why that is. And you can speculate that a lot of it has to do with the simple therapeutic effect of talking to another human being, right? It's important. Mm-hmm. But then there's a question, something like psychoanalysis is meant to do more than simply make you less depressed. It's supposed to be life enriching and a form of self-examination, essentially. So just to correct that, I don't think that all forms of therapy then amount to the same thing. But when you look at a specific kind of effectiveness, yeah, you see similar results.
Well, and so the problem of types, we started off the podcast here giving some little snarky introduction of, you know, myself as intuitive and thinking or whatever, as opposed to feeling and sensing. And so that's this thing that's associated with modern personality tests used by businesses is something that came out of Jung initially. And it looks like from this that he came up with that, at least in part, to guard against bad ways of doing therapy. You know, there's no right or wrong answer. Should you be a thinking person or a feeling person, according to this? Like, if you're too far in one direction or the other, then you're pretty fucked up. You're repressing the part of you that is the other side. You're out of balance. He seemed to think that Freud in particular was a thinking, was a extrovert maybe. And so he was imposing this as a value judgment on his patients, such that their progress would be measured in part by how well they're meeting Freud's expectations in this regard. And Jung wanted to diffuse that and say, no, that's actually just because your particular personality type, Mr. Freud, you have to realize that there's a range of these things, and to impose a moral or a clinical hierarchy on them is kind of fucked up. You just say, no, this person just is more introverted versus extroverted than that person. That's just the way they are. And you have to adjust when you're engaging in therapy with them based on what your type is and what their type is. So that's one of the basic things you have to know about yourself before you engage in therapy. And it's just a tragic and, I think, historical outcome that this system that appears from this text, at least, was created for such a beneficial purpose is now being used by businesses to determine, like, can we properly control you enough to give you this job?
That's not...
No.
No.
Why would they do it as part of your employment application, which they sometimes do? I know they also do it sometimes after you have the job to determine sort of how the manager should work with you.
Yeah, that's always been my experience. Nobody's ever asked for my Myers-Briggs on an application.
No, I worked for a company that screened people with a personality.
I've done it multiple tests. Yeah.
Really?
I was told, actually, I was hired despite the personality test saying, do not hire him. Yeah. And then the consultant, the people who were the administrators of the personality test, were shocked when they learned that I was going to be hired. And do not hire him. Do not hire him. She hired me anyway.
You're too full of yourself. You want to run the company nor not be associated with it at all.
How did you do in that job?
Not bad. I mean,
he's not in it anymore.
Did you last or did you?
I was there for 3 years.
Oh, all right. Well, that's a good hire then.
Yeah, I survived. That's a good hire.
I consider myself basically unemployable despite my having a job, you know, and that a personality test could probably tell that. I had in past jobs, I was employable. I didn't embarrass myself, but I was not happy about being in those environments.
I was never really in a bad environment.
Even in good environments, I wanted to start breaking stuff by a month of working in a place.
Wow, we have very different personalities.
Well, Seth, you take pride in your work and you enjoy meetings.
I don't enjoy meetings. In fact, I'm becoming less and less tolerant of meetings. I'm a little burned out, but I'm like a people pleaser type. And whatever I do, doesn't matter what the job is, my goal is to do it perfectly or better. And then start saying, looking at all the ways in which it could be done more efficiently or what have you, or expand the role. And usually that serves me well. Sometimes people aren't interested in hearing what you have to say. But when you're in a decent environment and you're like, hey, here's all the ways in which even having this kind of a job on the team is a mistake and we should be doing this, people respond positively to it, I find. And if they don't, you don't want to be working for those people.
So what's the Jungian analysis of that? Because, you know, Jung says it's one of the virtues of modern civilization that we can divide up our personalities in this way, that we can stay focused on a task. And, you know, ancient people couldn't do that. But yet he also says, you know, one of the things you should get out of therapy is to not be so one-sided. And I feel like I've done too much of that. I spent too much time emotionally exploring myself through music and through whatever. Unless a job is really enthralling me, I can't shut off those parts.
Hmm. Well, maybe you're dealing with it in a more healthy way than me, because you're not an alcoholic and gotten divorced. So there's a plus.
Field is in, man.
It's a very personal, partially examined life, this episode.
In a very special episode.
So tell us all the stuff from your therapy, Wes. And do you do dream reports? You don't do that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, free associate and do dreams, everything.
Do you ever pretend to be a quadriplegic and try to get one of those sex therapists that only serve, like in that movie with Helen Hunt?
They don't just serve quadriplegics, but no, I've never done that. I know people who have done it. They're not quadriplegics, but...
Is that what they're called? Sex therapists?
Well, they're called surrogates. It's a step up from prostitution. What can you say?
That sounds exactly like prostitution.
It's prostitution with a new agey veneer to it. So
what can Jung say about it?
It doesn't feel as dirty.
It's called... Sex surrogacy is to prostitution as fair trade coffee is to Folgers. Is that...
This is all... None of this is relevant.
I was trying to bring it back by what the Jungian analysis of the leader of the tribe gets to have sex with every woman before they get married or whatever, but he's standing in for the god. So there's these like ancient scams.
That sounds like something that's only ever been in movies. I don't believe that's actually... Oh, it's definitely a scam. Everything serves a power structure.
How does his comments about the healthy mythology speak to the concerns from Freud and many others about myth being a way that leaders exploit everybody? Is the fact that it has numinosity overcome by the fact that it is being used primarily to control you, to keep you down? Just, I don't see acknowledgement from somebody like Jung, who supposedly read Freud here, of the downside of religion historically.
Yeah.
Well, Jung could just be basically buying into Freud's criticism of religion while simultaneously saying that as a device, it functions to serve these particular needs. Or are those two things not compatible?
I'm not sure. I was describing a little of Jung's positive comments about religion and how it provided meaning to tribes who then become alcoholics and things when the imperialists come in and get rid of their native religion. And she just immediately, female circumcision, like, how could you say there's anything positive about these ignorant bastards with their superstitions oppressing each other?
Who said that?
I'm putting words in her mouth, but that was the sentiment of my wife. And I was trying to describe this positive stuff about religion he was saying.
Well, that's a legitimate point, don't you think?
Yeah, you know, he's not concerned with ethics here, so maybe we don't need to. But ultimately, but he thinks that if you're a psychologically healthy person, if you're in touch with your other side, with your unconscious, then you're going to be a generally more compassionate, open-minded person, able to think more clearly and empathize with people. You know, it's one of those types of virtue ethics, ultimately, that's supposed to come out of psychological health. So talking about ethics is relevant.
First of all, I think when he talks about the function of religion, he's talking about the motifs and the, you know, ritual is important, but it's ritual insofar as you're physically acting out a symbology, right? Like the whole, it's spring, so we have rabbits and sheaves and we burn wheat on the altar and those sorts of things. Obviously, things like human sacrifice, like there's no defensibility under his system. There's no way in which human sacrifice or clitorectomies or whatever can function in a healthy way in his structure. But I don't think he had that kind of stuff in mind.
You don't think he would think that, you know, obviously it's not healthy for the victim, but that for the other people engaging in it, that far from making them savage, that it is serving some the same role of ritual.
Well, no,
is giving meaning. I mean, even if you're a victim, if you think that this is meaningful, if that you're giving your life to save the earth from the sun god destroying everything, that this is somehow positive.
I'd have to think about that. Isn't that what Payne's argument was in the Fame episode? Wasn't he basically saying that there's
we get a psychological boost out of this kind of stuff. He wasn't saying it's good. He wasn't.
No, I agree. He was, but there's the psychological need that we have for rituals.
This is maybe a good transition to a last topic, which is this a fundamentally tragic view of human nature in the way that Freud sort of is? That Freud seems to think we're just these animals. You know, this is in Civilization of Discontents. We have these instincts that we just have to repress in order to live in society. And so the choice is between acting out these dangerous things or being repressed. And so the best we can do is to, well, sublimate and just cope with the fact that we're sort of fundamentally fucked up. Where it seems for Jung that that's really not the case, that getting in touch with all these parts is not that the nasty stuff is better left repressed or just channeled in a certain way. He seems, maybe he's just not focusing on those more Freudian cases here, because it does seem like he's not trying to contradict Freud so much as saying, I believe in Freud plus, you know, that Freud is completely on target in some of his analyses, but he's just using this technique that he got from some analyses and like a sledgehammer on everything. And that's just messed up, that he's distorting particularly the dreams and people's psyches that are having these problems related to archetypes. At the same time, he does make a comment. The sad truth is man's real life consists of a complex of inexorable opposites. Life is a battleground. And so that's, you know, one of the reasons we need religion. Is because we might think in our everyday life, we're walking around and, you know, we're fine without religion. But when suffering comes, we end up needing some way to channel that. So in that way, it sort of sounds like Freud's, I don't know if pessimism is the right word, but his resignation to a hard life. Very much unlike the New Age caricature of Jung that says that if you sort of explore deeply enough, then all your problems become irrelevant. So what'd you think? His take of human nature, did you get anything out of this? You feel more wise now?
Well, I think I said early on that I was sympathetic to some of the things he was saying while still feeling like there needed to be some empirical work done behind them. there are parts where I feel like the thing about how you can have a precognition of your own death that manifests itself that way seems a little far-fetched.
Or certainly, again, unless, you know, if you're already sick and your body knows that you're sick, that I could at least see. But the example he gave of, you know, you get in a plane crash next year and somehow your body knows about that and gives you precognitive dreams. Like, you're definitely moving to the strong pro-parapsychology version of Jung there, if that's the example you go with.
Right. And I certainly fall into that camp of feeling like culturally in the West, we're disconnected from our kind of lived bodily experience in such a way that, and we're taught to fear death. And so if we were more connected with our lived experience and understood that death was a part of life, perhaps we would have a different kind of knowledge about our own experience. The idea that your body could somehow manifest that in dreams, as a foreshadowing in dreams, is, I mean, I don't know what to do with that. But I don't think that Jung's view is pessimistic, Mark, or that it's negative. I think, again, he's diagnosing what he sees as the symptom of the age, and he's trying to tie it into his personal experience of having treated people individually. Let me read a passage from near the end. It is this state of affairs that explains the peculiar feeling of helplessness of so many people in Western societies. They have begun to realize that the difficulties confronting us are moral problems, and that the attempts to answer them by a policy of piling up nuclear arms or by economic competition, in quotes, is achieving little, for it cuts both ways. Many of us now understand that moral and mental means would be more efficient, since they could provide us with psychic immunity against the ever-increasing infection. So, Wes, I guess this is what you were talking about earlier on when you mentioned about him bringing this back to morality, that what he's saying is we're not just talking about a psychological disorder. So let's just sort of put it out generally. As we try to be more and more rational or treat our experiences and the world in more rational ways, and we lose touch with this instinctive part of our experience, which manifests itself through symbols, whether it's through a dream or not, or symbolically interpreting the world instead of, you know, in a kind of rational scientific way. This instinctive part crops up in all these different areas, and it bursts through in our conscious experience, and it comes through in our dreams, and we pretend like it doesn't exist, but it does. And it's the mind is trying to create, or the body, I'm not really sure what you want to call it, the mind, but is trying to create an equilibrium because we're out of balance. And he's saying that we're out of balance morally, that reason is not, and this is a Humean view, that reason is not sufficient for determining moral action. It can tell you what your options are, but it doesn't give you any motivation to do it. And so, you know, I see ways in which I could spin the Jungian view expressed in this work along with the moral sentiment theory, and like you said earlier, Mark, maybe something about virtue, to basically say, okay, well, now we've got a psychological account. In Aristotle's virtue, we had a kind of social account. Hume's, I wouldn't call it moral psychology, but, you know, sentiment is kind of like a more modern faculty-based approach, even though I think Adam Smith was much more sophisticated than that. And here Jung is just giving us a more empirical 20th century psychological version of the same thing, or that accords with that. I'm sympathetic to that.
Well, that's great. At least the two of us found ways to relate this to the ongoing dialogues we've got going in our heads. Do you feel similarly informed, Wes? Did you feel like jumping in and relating this to 10 other things we've already covered? Or are you just so steeped in psychology that it just was a matter of Freud and Jung situating? What did you get out of this?
I enjoyed the reading. I was a little disappointed that it was a little thin and for a public audience, but and it is my first real introduction to Jung. I feel like I should have gotten to him earlier. It's interesting stuff. And I, like I said, I think the fundamental points he's making about the importance of dream symbolism and symbols in general, I buy that. And also, you know, some of the implications for interpreting dreams. On the other hand, it's a little unclear to me his critique of Freud. You know, he talks of discarding the ways in which modern humans have sort of discarded their symbols or these unconscious elements. And it's a little unclear to me what the difference between that and repression is. But I think if I were to read more, it might clear some of that up.
This is probably a good place to mention there's a Not School group going on right now that I am leading on a very different essay of his, Answer to Job, that is an analysis of symbolism in the Bible. It ends up being a psychoanalytical account of what the hell God could have been thinking in being such a dick to Job, and how then the Jesus story is supposed to be kind of an answer to this. It ends up being a very Hegelian take on the growth of self-consciousness. That long ago we talked about Hegel's notion of God as the universe coming to consciousness of itself. Well, here it's God himself as a personality that apparently is like an unconscious brute, as the Old Testament Yahweh. But then, just like in Hegel's story, the slave gains this superior self-consciousness to the master, man, Job, gains this moral superiority and insight that God does not have, because God sort of forgets to consult his omniscience, is the way Jung puts it several times. And so then by making himself into Jesus as a follow-up story to the Job story, he's attempting to take on the role of man and gain that insight that he did not have. And, you know, so it's a pretty interesting, if you're wondering, what does theology become with this basic Jungian approach? Well, it becomes something really weird. It becomes this really kind of entertaining analysis of myths. So I'll just recommend that to folks, and maybe there'll be another recording that at some point posted that people can hear, or you can just join Not School and read all the stuff that we're writing about that. So, any other last words?
Worth reading. I got the whole book on Kindle. There's like 6 other essays in it. I don't know that I'll get around to reading them soon, but it's not what I expected. I thought we were going to get the, as I said, the Joseph Campbell version of Jung, and that's not what this is at all. It's provocative, but that's it. If I'm going to criticize other authors for not arguing and engaging with, then in this case, without seeing the empirical work that underlies some of the assertions that he's making, I have to kind of like take it for granted and then look at the edifice that he builds on it. But all in all, enjoyed it.
All right. Next time, we're going to read Karl Popper's Conjectures and Refutations from 1963, specifically the introduction and chapters 1 and 2.
Who suggested that?
The reason that we're doing that sooner rather than later is because somebody made a big donation to us and wanted to do Philosophy of Science. And so we say, oh, okay. And why? The reason we did Jung now is actually because Dylan was going to be too busy to do this one with us. So we had to think of a good topic that we thought maybe he wouldn't care about as much as other things. And at that moment, somebody gave us a multi-$100 donation and said, you should do Jung. And so that was one that was on our list anyway. We won't do just anything just because somebody gives us money. But if it's something we kind of want to do anyway.
We're not sex surrogates.
That's yeah, then we will, you know, it'll go into our consideration of what we do soon. So keep that in mind, big donors. Big donors, we want to thank, since our last recording, have included Jonathan Tindall, Christian Madsberg, Stephanie Jones, Christopher Frederick, a.k.a. Fred, Daniel Lilly, Forrest Heidel, Malcolm Hansen, Yannick Kilberger, William Saxby, Frederick Kiesche, Patrice Jacob, Jack Shepard, Patricia Cook, Stephen Robinson, Deshaun Sauvilge, Martin Dempsey, Jules Wanderer, Courtney Thompson, Joseph Johns, Marcus Burley, and William Altmiller. In addition to those people, there were many smaller dollar donors. For instance, those that became PEL citizens at the $5 a month rate, where they could join in discussion groups like the one I just mentioned about Jung. You can propose one yourself. You don't have to know anything about it in advance. And of course, if you get that, you can also get immediate access, even just joining for 1 month, to the store of recordings of past Not School groups and other bonus content that we put up there. If you don't want to go that route, just check out partiallyexaminedlife.com. We have supplemental posts on this and other episodes that you can then join and discuss right there on there. We also have a Facebook group that many, many, many people have joined and can start their own conversations about whatever there. You can follow us on Twitter. We love hearing from you through Twitter, email, whatever. We'd also appreciate a nice review on our iTunes store page if you like this episode. Thank you and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
And we may all know Bedlam just by peeling back the face we have achieved. And we may all find someone off tomorrow morning and find myself in bed with someone else. And I'm a rotten man, a misbegotten man, because I'll and we may all